When I called her, she told me that she was leaving her husband and that I should meet her at the corner of Ventura Boulevard and Coldwater Canyon in about an hour. She had left her husband, so we decided to move in together. We found a place in Malibu. In the following weeks, we spent hours and hours talking, working, researching, and investigating my experiences with Rama. I made a couple of business trips to New York and Chicago during the month of November. I also made one stop in Ohio to get more details on the Peruvian horsefly in Peru. That seemed to be coming together. I started some correspondence going back and forth to Peru. At the same time, whenever in any city, I would hit the libraries in search of more proof of the things Rama had told me. So far, everything was checking out. I was reading all kinds of books, mostly on esoterics and metaphysics. I even went as far as checking out Greek mythology. I got most of my information about the private life of Christ at the New York Library. I screened the print of Jesus Christ Superstar a couple of times and also discovered that the history of the Roman Empire could throw some new light on the psychology and thinking of the times of Jesus, in regard to his teachings, and the prevailing political mood. Riding back to Los Angeles, I read the Book of the Pyramid Prophecies. Rama was right. Every significant date for mankind is written in that ancient stone monolith. By November 25, 1974, I had managed to make two appointments that could possibly take me to Peru in the coming months. While in New York, my people told me that going back to Peru was okay with them, but I would have to talk to some of the studio people in Hollywood, then perhaps attend another meeting in Mexico before I could be sent to Lima. I took care of the arrangements by way of several conferences at 20th Century Fox, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer and Warner Brothers. It was set, I was to go to Mexico during the second week of December. As far as Roy was concerned, on December 5 I was to meet him in San Francisco to take care of the last details on the Peruvian horse buy, details that would determine whether or not it was going to take place. That gave me almost a week to continue with my research and studies. The next few days were spent at the UCLA Parapsychology Department, trying to learn about spirits, incarnation, reincarnation and astronomy. I found that everything Rama told me was very true, and absolutely did not conflict with science or religion. By this time, my friend, Lynn, and I had set up housekeeping in Sherman Oaks in the San Fernando Valley and I was prepared to begin writing. Chapter 15. Chicho the Author. I spent the first days of December, 1974, in San Jose, California, studying in some of the Rosicrucian libraries. The Rosicrucians make no secrets of their knowledge and are willing to share it with anyone who cares to take the time to cultivate his or her spirit. Among the many books I found is one called The Mastery of Life, which can be obtained simply by dropping them a card with one's name and address. I was impressed with the Rosicrucians' knowledge of spirit, scientific values, instructions for the use of hidden powers, and their link to Egypt. I found many similarities between Rama's teachings and Rosicrucian theories, which described in plain, simple language the relationship of the soul to the astral planes, spiritual guides, guardian angels, and intuition, something tells me consciousness. These phenomena, according to the Rosicrucians, are electromagnetic microfrequencies which tune a person in with the fourth dimension. On December 5th, after finishing my work in the San Jose libraries, I drove to San Francisco. I was supposed to pick up Roy at the airport on Friday by 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It was a pleasure to see Roy again, especially since he brought news that increased my chances of returning to Peru to an even 85%. We spent most of our day in the city, then drove to a Peruvian horse ranch in Santa Rosa, California, for a meeting scheduled the following day, Saturday, December 7. 317 That evening, Roy and I were invited to attend a Bible reading meeting that was held each weekend at the ranch, on either Fridays or Saturdays. Before going into the room, Roy encouraged me to discuss my Andes Mountains experience and subsequent research with the group. By this time, Roy had become very interested in my project and had been doing some checking on Rama's material, and we'd spent hours exchanging information. We even had a few bets regarding several great world political figures who had some definite characteristics of the Antichrist. I respected Roy's contribution to my book project because he was a stickler for documentation. When he said something, it was always corroborated with facts and evidence. He obviously had good sources of information. I was very reluctant to talk about my conversations with Rama to the Bible study group. Usually when Roy asked me to discuss this subject with anyone, I refused. I had a message of purpose and goodwill from other intelligences in our solar system. I wasn't interested in making reports of UFO sightings. I also didn't like to be bothered with people's incredulity and annoying questions, like really? Do they have only one eye? Are they really green? There were about 15 people in the room for the Bible study session. Roy said he would be the one to relate my story about the meetings with an extraterrestrial. When he had finished outlining my experiences, it seemed only natural that I stand up and say a few words. The room was silent as I gave them a description of the events that had taken place in June of that year. Then the question and answer period began. I was straightforward and to the point. Some believed my story, some didn't. It didn't matter to me one way or another, I was prepared for both attitudes. One young woman, who was a regular of the Bible reading sessions, suddenly stood up and said she didn't believe a word I was saying. "You met Satan up there," she said. "This is all the work of the devil." I didn't know what to say. I tried to reason with her, explaining it wouldn't be possible for Satan to start turning people onto Christ, but my body broke out into a cold sweat. Then I remembered that Rama had said before the end of the year someone would say this openly to me, in a room full of people around a table. The flashback, clear and almost lifelike, seemed to put me in touch with Rama's spirit. She had also said that she would be with me when this event took place. I immediately relaxed and felt energized by her presence. The hostess sensed the situation, called the meeting to order and suggested we all hold hands and pray. The girl who said I'd met Satan kept praying that Jesus Christ have mercy on my soul because I'd come in close contact with the devil. It wasn't pleasant, but I assumed the experience was necessary and accepted it, resolving to put some study into the attitudes which inspired this kind of fear whenever the subject of UFOs came up in my conversations with people. We returned to the hacienda the next day for a luncheon appointment. I had more time to talk to the hostess of the horse ranch, who was an intelligent, well-informed young woman. We spent most of the afternoon discussing spiritual issues. I'd met this woman several times before, but always on business. Today, our common ground was Jesus Christ. She was not only a good Christian, but also very well read. She gave me a couple of books written by a friend of hers, Hal Lindsey, opening a new source of information about the life and death of Christ, complete with valid reports and historical facts. By the time I left the hacienda that afternoon, I felt only good vibrations. She had planted a new seed in my mind concerning Christ as a man. I would never have guessed that a young woman with all the material things in life could be so down to earth when it came to the teachings of Christ. I left Roy in San Francisco, where he rented a car to do some sightseeing in and around California. We made plans to meet each other in Los Angeles in 4 or 5 days. I had to rush back, as I was booked on the Monday noon flight to Mexico City. My meeting there was for the purpose of straightening out the situation of a certain motion picture business in Peru. This was to be the last time I would get involved in negotiations as an intermediary between the Peruvian government and the international world of motion pictures. Things went smoothly the first 2 days. I was so sure there would be no complications that I called New York and told my partners that everything was working out perfectly. Early the next morning, I received a phone call from the number one man in Mexico City. He said they had decided not to go ahead with the deal. "Thank you very much, don't call us, we'll call you. The deal falling through didn't bother me too much, somehow I'd been prepared for it. By this time, I was making an effort to put into practice the principles Rama had been teaching me. Taking a positive attitude, I decided that I must be in Mexico City for some purpose other than business. I raided a few libraries and museums in Mexico City, searching for more evidence of ancient cosmonauts. I found a copy of the Rodolfo Benavides book, Enoch de los Tiempos, which in English means, In the Night of Time. In this work, Benavides describes astral projection in detail. He refers to God as the eternal thought of creation, using familiar terminology such as the third force, and calling the energy components of the spirit Ananas and Anionites. I also studied some Mayan and Aztec archaeology, calendars, beliefs and myths. All the evidence pointed to the fact that these ancient people believed that they were direct descendants of the sun. I knew there was a place in Mexico called Palenque. At the bottom of one of the pyramids, there is a huge tombstone with a bas-relief carving of a humanoid piloting a rocket. I couldn't imagine anyone could still believe UFOs were fiction when some ancient Mexican sculptor had carved this historical document in stone some 10,000 years ago. I wanted to go to Palenque and see this stone for myself in the worst way. But I had to meet Roy in Los Angeles and someone else in Dallas, Texas, to discuss the possibilities of making a film in Peru about Peruvian horses. I consoled myself with looking at the photographs of this marvel, which I had already seen illustrated in one of the von Daniken books. I couldn't miss this meeting. My only hope of going back to Peru was Roy and his Peruvian horse deal. I kept working on successful images, concentrating on the process a step at a time. Roy and I spent the next few days discussing the details of the negotiations, did some sightseeing, and visited many places around Southern California, including a few movie studios. By the time Roy returned to Ohio, the horse deal in Peru was almost reality. It was mid-December, the holiday season was approaching. Roy and Betty, his fiancée, invited me to spend Christmas with them in Michigan. I accepted their kind invitation and made plans to meet them in Swanton, Ohio, a few days before the holidays. In the meantime, I needed to take a few days to straighten out my personal situation in a Beverly Hills court where I had failed to appear for a certain July 15th appointment. Since I was living with a friend in Sherman Oaks, I hadn't been back to my Beverly Hills apartment. My failure to respond to my court summons led to the issuance of a bench warrant for my arrest. I felt like a fugitive. I was on the lam, so to speak. I decided to do something about this problem. I got in my car and drove non-stop to New York to see the one man who had the kind of political influence I needed. I hadn't discussed this particular problem with him, but now it was necessary. I'd thought my court case would be a simple one, with the judge giving me a slap on the wrist and maybe putting me on probation for a year. That didn't seem to be the case. I knew Harold Barton was the only person who could get me off the hook on this one. As embarrassing as it was to tell him about my legal difficulties, he was the one connection that could help me untangle this legal knot. As it turned out, I didn't get to see Harold Barton that day. I arrived in New York on December 19, 1974, but since he hadn't been expecting me, he wasn't available. In fact, I never saw him again. While writing this book, early in 1976, I always watched the 7 o'clock evening news on CBS with Walter Cronkite. I saw a picture of my friend and business associate I had known as Harold Barton, flash across the TV screen. The news announcer said he'd been assassinated in Athens, Greece. It was then I learned that his real name was Richard Welsh, and that he was one of the top officials of the CIA. I had been under the impression that Harold Barton was with the International Investment Investigations Organization, the III, as he called it, and that he'd been headquartered in Lima, Peru, for many years. This was another surprise for me, because I had been under the impression that he only took quick trips there to meet me. Reflected back on one of my conversations with Rama. She'd mentioned that the man I worked for was destined to be assassinated sometime around the end of 1975 or early 1976. At the time, I didn't want to believe her, but this was only one of several of her predictions that had come true with amazing accuracy. Upon hearing the news about this assassination, I began remembering back in time to September 1968, when my work with him began to develop. What you are about to read now may clarify why I was so mistrustful of Rama when I first met her in the Andes Mountains. At that time, because of my own undercover activities, I had begun to believe that everyone worked for the CIA. It all began in Copenhagen, Denmark, in the fall of 1968. I was doing some freelance work for a Universal Pictures production, which was under the direction of Alfred Hitchcock. An American couple approached me and asked me to join their organization, explaining in detail what my assignment would be. It seemed easy enough, but somewhat dark and mysterious. I expressed my concern about the secrecy aspect of the assignment they were offering me. They said their work, or our work if I chose to accept it, would be to report events as they happened in certain places in the world where the news is carefully censored before it hits the wire services. At the time, I had just turned 24. I was naive, inexperienced and somewhat idealistic. The proposal sounded intriguing. My recruiters told me I would be serving a nation in its intelligence work. I wasn't that naive. I was fairly certain they were associated with the CIA, and that what they were suggesting involved some kind of spy work. My knowledge of languages made me valuable to them. I remembered, with some amusement, that my college career placement center had suggested such work due to my advanced linguistic abilities. The American couple tried to convince me that the assignment was definitely not a spy job. They told me that a private enterprise, an international company, whose goal it was to eradicate the spread of communism throughout the world, was making this offer. The company, known as International Investment Investigations, was a powerful organization where everyone had his or her own specific line of work, with an attitude of "we don't ask questions because the less we know the better off we are." When I asked for more specifics about the proposed assignment, they told me it would mean reporting on serious journalistic information in various countries. I thought about the offer for about a month. I consulted my mother, a woman who works behind the scenes in the entertainment industry. She listened to my account of the meeting I did with the representatives in Denmark. She told me that organizations like Mission Impossible and James Bond aren't fictional, they do exist and operate more or less in the same manner as is seen in the movies or television series. Even though I didn't really know whether or not to believe what she was saying, she said something that made good sense. These movies and television programs are based on actual events, taken from secret files after they have been dismissed. Most of these secret outfits, she said, had all kinds of specialized personnel to handle various assignments. I told her lots of people got killed doing that kind of work and it wasn't worth the risk and aggravation that goes with it. My mother reminded me that tens of thousands of American motorists die on the roads every year. When I made up my mind to join them, I was given an appointment in Rome at the end of November that year. I was told to go to Castel Sant'Angelo on a Saturday afternoon, to carry an umbrella and wear a red carnation in my lapel. Someone would contact me. As I waited for my contact to arrive at the designated location, a girl stopped, asking for directions. I gave them to her. She listened, then asked me to cross the bridge and go to a sidewalk cafe where I would be meeting a man wearing a hat and a blue and white coat. He was a young fellow, very pleasant and well educated. He told me he was working as an international public relations man for a major American organization in Rome. I imagined a job interview like this was the beginning of a whole new adventurous career for someone like me. As I was a rambunctious young man, always in search of a new adventure, I accepted the job on the spot, without thinking about what I was getting myself into. We went to the 84 Club to drink a toast to my future. When we said goodbye that evening, he made me memorize an address and phone number in New York City, where I would be reporting sometime around the second week of January, 1969. That was the first time I heard the name Harold Barton. He was the man I was to report to during and after my training. I felt a lot better about the work when the young man assured me that in our work we don't get killed, we're not CIA agents. We just compile journalistic facts, calling M as we see M. I went to pick up my car, which was parked somewhere near Piazza di Spagna. I took a cab from Via Veneto, asking the driver to take me there. As I crossed the street I saw a red car approaching, fast. It was aiming right at me. I tried to run, but didn't make it to the other side of the street. The car hit me, throwing me some distance, then sped away into the night. I was in St. Giacomo Hospital in Rome for about 2 months. As far as I was concerned, that was the end of my short career as an international spy. I was pretty sure I was supposed to have been killed that night. The car very purposefully struck me. Although I eventually recovered from my injuries, I had no desire to ever be seen in public with those people again. It wasn't worth it. I got out of it fast. At least I thought I did. In August, 1970, I was picked up at a movie screening in Lima, Peru, by Harold Barton himself. He was mysterious and cautious. I was in no mood to listen to another spy story. I didn't even give the man a chance to explain the reason for his visits once he told me his name. I told him to take a flying leap as I was still feeling aches and pains in many bones of my body as a result of my Roman Odyssey 2 years earlier. He asked me to listen to him for just 5 minutes, and to try to be reasonable. I listened, but only to be polite. I was determined not to be any part of his operation. I wasn't eager to get killed. I was very impressed by this dignified man. And when the head man of a top secret organization comes to you personally and tells you that as a duty to your country, the least you could do is listen, you listen. This is what I remember of the conversation. "Charles, I understand exactly how you feel, but this happens to be one of those special cases. It's true that I have the CIA, FBI, NATO and many other secret services working with us, agencies and agents that would make James Bond look elementary. So what do you want from me?" He asked me if I remembered the names of 3 people. I said, "Yes, I do. I went to school with all of them, we were best buddies, real cut-ups." "Charles, did you know they are in top positions in the Peruvian government?" "Yes, of course I know." "Very well then, now you know this is what makes you so valuable to us. But you're talking about my high school days, it's been more than 11 years since we've seen each other. You're lying."
"What do you mean?"
"You were seen together at a party in March of this year." "Hey, yes, you're right, I'd forgotten about that. I did see them for a few hours that night, 2 years ago. But I never remember men at an orgy." "Excuse me, sir, how did you know about this, even about the party? Don't forget I'm the top man of this operation. I want you to realize that if there were another person in this world who could do the job, I wouldn't be here personally." I understood perfectly what he was saying. This was a 1 in a 1,000,000 chance. 3 of my closest high school buddies and classmates were at that moment extremely influential and powerful in the government of a country where this Harold Barton was representing a lot of American enterprise and investments. He explained very carefully that he wasn't trying to recruit me as a regular. To prove it, he said there would be no training period. Reluctantly, I asked what my mission would be. "Very simple. Just go to Peru, visit, socialize, party, wine, dine, and orgy with them. In your spare time, make sure you do some sightseeing. Is that all?"
"That's it."
"Incredible. You'll be very safe, because I don't know of any cases of people getting killed for visiting and partying with old friends. How am I going to get in touch with them again? Last time we all got together was by some silly coincidence, after years of silence between us. You leave the details to me. I need you badly, and I can assure you you'll never regret this." I agreed to go ahead with it, with the assurance that I would be valuable to Harold on certain specialized assignments. During the last months of 1971, I spent time in Europe, Washington, D.C., and Puerto Rico, being briefed by several companies that had heavy investments in the country where I was to be assigned. On January 15, 1972, I started my assignment, which was the beginning of a series of events that would eventually lead me to the country where I would meet Rama 2 years later. I made at least 5 trips to Peru, partying and having a good time with my ex-classmates. I also met Harold 2 or 3 times a year for tedious sessions of hard questioning. Our meetings could take place anywhere in the world. I'd get a plane ticket and instructions in the mail, designating a meeting place and a time, usually only a few days in advance. As always, secrecy and mystery were part of the setup. I thought Harold was being overly dramatic, but since I felt that I had nothing to fear, I went along with all the mystery, continuing to move about freely. As far as I was concerned, the intrigue only added spice to the whole situation. Strangely enough, his questions were mainly about the people on the street, not my friends in government. He wanted to know what the average person thought of the government, what was the national mood. Was there enough food and fuel supplies for those cities? He even asked about communications services, and if the news media covered the news as it really happened. He used to bring newspaper clippings of affairs in that country which had appeared in some American newspapers. I'd give him my unbiased impressions, knowing he always wanted me to go into great detail. At times, the questioning sessions left me with the feeling that he was trying to trick me into giving him answers. By 1972, I was going to various South American countries several times a year. Upon my return from each visit, I would give Harold my reports. By January 1, 1974, the relationships between the U.S. companies and Peru, the country where this story takes place, had gone sour, despite the efforts of American businesses to deal with the revolutionary government in Peru. By that time, I was no longer a spectator. I was taking an active part in the negotiations, trying to save some of the investments made by international corporations. By then, my activities no longer seemed mysterious, but legitimate international business, with all the headaches that go with it. The last time I saw the man I called Harold Barton alive was late May, 1974, at 3 o'clock in the morning at the Holiday Inn in Montreal, Canada. It was during this meeting he asked me to return to Peru around the middle of June that year. He wanted me to report to him on all the disturbances that would be taking place by the end of July, when the Peruvian government planned to take over all the news media in that country. It was while on this particular mission I met Rama in the Andes Mountains. On December 19, 1974, the day I drove to New York to see Harold Barton, breaking every speed law on the way, I still had no idea I would never see him alive again. When I couldn't see him, I decided to postpone my appearance at the Beverly Hills Court, pending my return to the United States after working out Roy's Peruvian horse deal. I spent the Christmas holidays with Roy and Betty in Michigan. We used this time to put together the details on the venture. I was to go to Peru, buy the horses and return to Ohio. I would stay in Peru a couple of months to take care of the exportation procedures. By the end of March, I was to come back with the horses and stay at his Peruvian horse ranch in Ohio and write my book. Everything so agreed, I was on a Brunif flight from Miami to Lima, Peru, by January 2, 1975. I fastened my seatbelt and let out a sigh of relief. This was the answer to my prayer, I thought. Some benevolent spirit had picked up my mental images of going back to Peru and sprayed them with that thought materializer. I arrived in Lima at 7 o'clock in the morning. I was a familiar face to immigration and customs officials. I entered the terminal and walked toward the car rental counters. I heard a familiar voice. "Can I get you a taxi, senor?" I turned around, dropping my luggage and briefcase, and ran to kiss and hug the beautiful creature who had called me. "Rama, You sweet baby, how did you know I was on this flight?
Oh, never mind. How are you?
How do I look?